Off the ball
on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
Okay, it was this time last year that the former Crewe Alexandra defender Andy Woodward alleged in an interview with The Guardian's Daniel Taylor that he'd been sexually abused as a child by the former football coach Barry Bunnell. What followed was the opening of a wound that for so long football had failed to acknowledge. Woodward's story, the starting point really for a flood of allegations of the most horrific child sexual abuse. It's emerged over the past year that hundreds, if not thousands, of children were abused by paedophiles operating within football over the last four decades. Probably the most high-profile player to reveal details of the abuse he suffered was Paul Stewart, man of the match for Tottenham in the 91 FA Cup final, former England international, also played for Liverpool, Manchester City, among many others. And Paul has just released his autobiography, which is called Damaged, and he joins us in studio now. Thanks a lot for coming into studio, Paul.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good afternoon.
This book, it's not your typical footballer autobiography. It's not an easy read. The opening chapters, in particular, when you detail the abuse that you suffered from the paedophile Frank Roper, your football coach as a kid, the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, the mental abuse, it's heartbreaking. It's very upsetting what you went through over that four-year period. Four decades on, how difficult was it for you to put those terrible memories onto paper?
Obviously, I was readdressing what had happened to me as a child. The reason for writing the book was because the story itself, I knew that other people had suffered. Do you know, if it was an autobiography about my football career, I probably wouldn't have written it because, you know, I didn't think that I reached the heights that some of the players that write books these days, and I probably wouldn't have bought it myself, but it did all change last November, and I knew that other people had suffered as I did as a child, and I wanted to tell my story in the hope that it would help them not take the path that I took along the way.
It was this day last year that Andy Woodward was interviewed by Daniel Taylor. It was published in The Guardian. There were stories in The Daily Mirror. You pick up The Daily Mirror and you realise now's the time for me to speak up. The personal transformation you've gone over the past year, you hadn't told your wife, you hadn't told your children, you hadn't told your parents. Quite literally nobody in the world knew what happened to you under Frank Roper during those 4 years.
That's right.
What has the last year been like?
Do you know what? It's been maybe a roller coaster of emotions at times. Overwhelming respect from people and the good wishes that have made it worthwhile, if you will. The fact that I've been contacted by numerous other lads that had been abused, and it's helped them to come to terms with it, which was my reasons for telling my story. So on that level, it's why I came forward.
The abuse started when you were 11. Take us back to your early days, 1 to 10. Your mother says in the autobiography that you're one of the happiest children you could meet during your formative years. What was your early life like?
We came as, and I know a lot of people came up struggling for money. You know, my dad was a labourer. We lived on a council estate. But do you know what? We were happy. You know, what we didn't have, we didn't want for. I used to play in the streets football every opportunity that I got with my older brother Gary.
This is just around Manchester.
This is just around Withenshaw in Manchester. So for all intents and purposes, you could say I was at a normal childhood. That's how I saw it, you know, and I was happy-go-lucky.
Yeah, regular childhood, settled family life.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. And, obviously that all changed when I met Frank Roper.
When did you first meet Frank Roper?
What happened was I was playing for the school team and he was watching the game, looking for players as they did in them days. He had a Sunday league team. He walked up and down the line and asked who was my parents, if you will, and my dad was there. And he approached and asked, would I want to play on a Sunday for his team? I had heard about Nova Juniors. They were renowned for having good teams. So,
they were a feeder club.
They were, yeah. And I saw it as a step towards what I dreamed of wanting to do all my life, which was play football. So I as much wanted to play for Nova as they wanted me to play for them, if you will.
Were you already thinking at 10, 11, I want to be a professional footballer? Did you know you had that sort of talent in you?
I wouldn't say I was you know, saying that I had that talent, but it's all I wanted to do. I didn't think that at any point I wasn't going to be a footballer, and you know, it may sound a bit conceited that, but it was just, I think it was every child's dream then, you know, when we were brought up as we were, you know, it was a way out of that life, if you will. So I don't think I was any different than any other child wanting to realise his dreams.
You paint a picture during the book of Roper essentially being a monster, but yeah. The man you knew when you were 11 years of age, who took this interest in your career, what was he like when you first met him?
He was a normal guy. You would think looked like he could help you with your career. Told my parents that's what he would be able to do, that he saw potential in me as being a good player. So, you know what it looked like? Everything was going to work out for the better, as opposed to what did happen.
How quickly then, after he took an interest in you, did the abuse start?
It escalated very quickly from when I joined the club. You know, within a matter of a couple of weeks, he touched me in the car, which I stated in the book. You know, he would ask if anyone wanted to drive the car, and you would straddle the gear stick and the handbrake, and he touched me. It seemed that it happened in a flash, but, you know, I just froze and then just forgot about it, if you will.
You're 11 at that stage, and like 11-year-olds, particularly 11-year-old boys, can be at different stages of maturity in terms of their understandings of relationships, of sex, of what's right and what's wrong. That first time when he did touch you, when he first abused you, in his car, in a dark place, off a football pitch, did you instantly know this is wrong?
I knew it wasn't right, of course. The thing was, he'd worked up to that stage, if you will, over a matter of weeks, not just with myself, but he'd groomed my parents and my brothers. He gave us gifts that we didn't have. I was used to having hand-me-downs from my brother's boots, and his, you know, he had his older brother's boots, if you will. So
he tried to buy everybody's trust.
Yeah, and he did buy the trust, but it wasn't just that. But he also threatened to kill my parents and my brothers. And, you know, I wasn't actually quite 11 when it started. I was just, I was still 10 years of age, nearly 11. And do you know when all that happens in such a short space of time? He'd made innuendos as well after touching me, but it seemed to come really, really quick and in such a short space of time that it went from the touching to the sexual abuse.
The sexual abuse isn't really possible without the mental abuse as well. And you mentioned there threatening to kill your parents. Now you can go, well, he's not going to do that.
Yeah,
but when you're 10 years of age, it's a very, very real thing.
It is. And, you know, and I think it's difficult for people to comprehend that when they're adults, that you just think, oh, he's not going to do that. But when you're a 10-year-old child and that's said to you, you know, by an adult, you believe it.
Did you think at the time, why me?
Yeah.
Why has he picked on me?
Yes, not just at that time. It's probably been something that I've thought about, you know, over the last 43 years. But of course, yeah, I didn't know how to get out of it. I felt that I was left with nowhere to turn, you know, the threats on my parents and my two brothers, then the gifts that he was bringing for my parents. So they all of a sudden got things that we weren't used to, and then he was threatening me out of sight of our earshot of them. So he knew exactly what he was doing. And as you quite rightly said, for a child of that age, it's very difficult to compute. You know, I thought, if I tell my dad, then my dad will end up in prison. You know, there were a lot of things that you shouldn't have to think about when you're a child. You should just be a child.
Yeah. Andy Woodward, in the first interview with Daniel Taylor, when he was talking about Barry Bunnell, said that he felt that Bunnell had targeted the softer, weaker boys. When you look at how you were as a 10, 11-year-old, do you look back now and think, yeah, was the target?
I've never classed myself as weak in any way, and I'm not saying that Andy is, but I didn't see it as that. I just think that he may have tested a few of the lads, and those that didn't speak up then became his major target, and I was one of those that didn't say a word, and once he's got hold of one, that seemed to be his MO, that he would make sure where possible that he was with you all the time. And do you know what, he would look like a long lost uncle when he sat in your house, and I would be sat there not knowing what to say, because I never knew whether I was going to get physically abused and abused, or just abused sexually. I was in a situation that I just felt there was no way out.
It was every day for 4 years, which is one of the most harrowing parts of the book when you read it. And when you think back to being a teenager yourself and the things that are important, and you split up with a girlfriend or you get caught drinking, and you're going to bed that night with the dread of what's going to happen the next day with your parents or whatever. When you're going to bed at night every day for 4 years, knowing that the next day is going to bring some form of abuse, what does that do to you mentally as well as physically? What does that do to you?
Well, I think it ruins you mentally. I felt that I was stripped of everything, self-confidence, belief, everything that a normal child should experience, I wasn't able to experience. And my only escape was the times when I was playing football, because I knew that he couldn't touch me while I was on the football field.
I did wonder that, the side where, because he's so closely associated with your football career, that how you managed to get that freedom, because everything about football was everything to do with Frank Roper. You were literally able to park it for those, whatever it was, 60, 70 minutes at that time?
Yeah, I knew for that short space, even though he would be shouting abuse on from the touchline, aimed particularly at me, if he didn't think I was doing what he wanted me to do. But I just felt that I couldn't be touched for that 60 minutes, as you say, or 80 minutes when I was playing football. For me, it was my only escape.
You say there was no real pattern to the abuse, in that maybe he was trying to keep you on edge all the time, in terms of whether it was sexual abuse, physical abuse. Sometimes he'd pick you up at school. He would pop up at places. Maybe you thought for the day you were clear, and he'd arrive in your house that evening. How draining is that? Trying to keep going day after day after day with no idea of when the end is going to come?
I don't know about draining, if that's the right way to put it. I just felt that I was trapped in a situation that whichever way I looked, there was no way out of, because I would be thinking of, well, if I tell my dad will kill him, plus then he won't bring the gifts that he's given me parents that they can't afford. What, I can't show that I love my parents, because when he gets me alone, he'll say, look at you, look how they dress you, they don't love you. So, there was a million things. So you just become numb. You just become numb and try not to think about any of it. And that's really how I dealt with it. I did stop speaking for a year, in terms of, when you say not speaking, if a teacher addressed me, then I would answer in short terms, but I would never engage in a conversation. I'd sit in the corner on my own. That was my way of trying to say, look, something's wrong here. My parents and they just thought that it was me growing up, and because I wanted to be a footballer so bad, that was just the way that I was.
Was that an instant transformation from the first day you were abused, that straight away you went back into your shell?
Yeah. I would say, well, within a very short space of time, and I genuinely was a happy-go-lucky kid.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I haven't got two words in me. And
your mother says you used to tell her everything. Again, she probably put it down to your desire to be a footballer, puberty, adolescence.
She says that in the book. And it was important for me to get my parents' view, because, You know, it was difficult enough having to go around and tell my parents when I decided to come forward. You know, it is something I guess no son would want to have to do, because I knew that their instant thought would be that they'd let me down. I wanted to tell them and reiterate, and I still reiterate now, that it wasn't their fault, because the MO that Frank Roper had was to groom not just your son, but yous also.
It is probably the most difficult part of the book when you talk about telling your parents, yeah. Because every parent wants to protect their children, but also every parent, I think, feels that they would know,
yeah,
when their child is going through a difficult period. And it wasn't just that Frank Roper took you out of your house. Frank Roper managed to get himself into your house.
He did, yeah.
He managed to get himself into your bedroom. He managed to get the complete trust. And that conversation with your parents and ongoing with your parents, because now that's something in their later years in life they still have to deal with every single day. And your mother talks about that she'll never know the full extent of what Roper did, because quite simply it'd kill her. But yeah, she now sees his face in front of her every night when she goes to sleep. She's absolutely tormented by what he did. Like, as a son who has gone through so much already, knowing that you're going to have to leave that sort of burden on your parents.
Yeah, and that's why it was very difficult for me to have them conversations, not just with my parents, but my brothers also. But, you know, I had to weigh up, and I asked each, you know, my parents and my brothers and my wife and my children, I said, look, if any doubt you have of me coming forward, then I respect that and I won't say a word. They all resoundingly said that they wanted me to tell my story, because they see how important the story has been in terms of trying to help other people. So, you know, I try almost daily to say to my mum in particular that, you know, it wasn't your fault, but I get why she's always going to feel guilty. And you know, I have to live with that as well. Despite everything that goes on in your life, there's still things that you have to deal with. And that is something that we are dealing with, and I'm still reiterating all the time that it wasn't your fault.
I'm sure there have been so many times over the years that you've looked back and beat yourself up about, why didn't I just tell somebody? Why didn't I do something different and end it? But then when you look at the way he was able to go into your parents' house, into an adult's house, and ingratiate himself with your family to earn the trust that he could come around in the evening, that at the end of a night he'd go, maybe I'm better off just staying, would end up at staying in your brother's room, and that for it to happen under their watch. The way, the brazen nature of Frank Roper, it is remarkable how he managed to get away with it, the confidence he had that he would get away with this.
Yeah, and you know, we have to look at society then in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and when you look at where it was going on, because it wasn't just football, we know that it was happening in the Catholic Church, at boarding schools. Children were seen and not heard in them days, and often if a child did come forward and say that something was happening, they wouldn't be believed. So society at that time, there was a problem with the issue around abuse, and nobody wanted to admit if it was happening, that it was happening, if you know what I mean.
You weren't the only one abused by Roper. He must have essentially dedicated his life to grooming children and grooming adults, because it seems he almost spent every waking hour of the day plotting and planning. He must have, for the level of detail and depth he went to, down to organising trips abroad. Yep. He spent some time in Ireland. He spent some time in America. He used to insist that he shared a room with you. Nobody at any stage on trips like that, anybody questioned it?
Well, first of all, he'd always make sure that one of my brothers was there, because that was a hold over me. Then when we were with our hosts, he would say that I was homesick and that my parents had asked him to look after me, therefore he had to stay with me. So he always had an answer for if anyone questioned. Not that they were questioning whether he was doing something, but if ever it was questioned, he always had an answer. You know, it was remarkable when you think about the years that he did it for, how he didn't get caught. But you know, and his answers were plausible. The kids come all the way from the UK to America. He's homesick. His parents have asked to look after me. And you know, when you look back, why would you not believe that?
Did you think at the time you were the only one within the team that was suffering this treatment?
I was the only one of that team. Purely and simply, I know that because I was with him 24/7. And that was his MO as well, you know, after me, and something I had to endure when I joined as an apprentice at Blackpool. He was scouting for them, so I had to see him on a weekly basis. And I noticed that there was another lad with him who has chose to stay anonymous, and that's that. I understand that, but you know, that's difficult now.
Have you spoken to him?
I have spoken to him, yeah. As a 53-year-old man, when I look back, you know, I sort of feel the guilt, because if I'd have said something, I might have been able to stop it. But, you know, I was 16, 17, and I'd got away from him, and I wanted to concentrate on my football career and not look like I was a trouble causer. And, you know, maybe sounds like I'm making excuses. Don't worry about it. I regret not speaking up when I should have done it as 17, 18 or a young 20-year-old.
Was there ever a time during the 4 years where you could have confided in somebody, where an opportunity arose that you look back and thought that was the chance?
No, I don't feel that. You know, he made sure that he controlled everything about me. So there was never a thought that I felt I could say something.
There was physical abuse as well, and that was maybe an opportunity where he almost was caught, that you came home, he'd given you a bit of a dig, you're crying, your mother notices, he arrives in the house and your mother punches him straight in the face. Why wasn't that the end of it?
Because he managed to talk his way around. I think you'll find that he used the excuse that Paul was upset because he thought his brother was going to be a player and he wasn't. And somehow he had an answer for every situation. And, you know, it was always plausible. When you look back now, it wasn't plausible. We know it wasn't plausible. We know that it's not natural for a man who's not a family member to be around a child of 11, 12 and 13, constantly 24/7. Yeah, back then it was plausible.
Had you any friends during that period?
No.
What about your football teammates?
No, none at all. He made sure that I didn't have friends. I mean, when we talk about him being outside the school gates almost every day, if he wasn't outside the school gates, he would be following somewhere close by to make sure that I didn't speak to anyone. If he caught me speaking to anyone, he would hit me first, punch me, bend my fingers back. And we got to remember, you know, coming from where I came from, it wasn't unheard of to come in with a few bruises, bangs and knocks from anywhere. So, you know, everything that he did, I realise now, was calculated, but it was always plausible.
That incident with your mother and Roper and how it could have been the end, and he managed to get his way out of it, was there an option for you there to say, I'm done with this? Or was it always football, football, football? I will put up with this because I want to be a footballer.
It was that. You know, I felt that he had the power to give and take away my football career. And nothing would have stopped me playing football.
Don't wish now that you just sacrificed your football career?
From what I've had to go through, maybe. Maybe I do, but I think I still would have made it without the abuse and the physical abuse from Frank Roper. So, do you know, as a kid, I didn't quite understand that. But now as a 53-year-old man, I think I was still determined to make it as a footballer. So I would have made it.
Because I think the subheading is interesting. You say football made him a victim. Football saved his life. It could well have been football made him a hero. Football ruined your life. You've chosen to look at it that way, that football was the outlet for you. Football was the good thing.
You know, even when I had all my problems off the field as I'm playing, that time on the pitch was still, and that before you walk out in the tunnel, and that time on the pitch still nothing can replace that. And for me, it was, I never had to think about Roper, what had gone on in my life. All I concentrated on the game that I loved.
How did it all end then? How did the abuse come to an end?
I think maybe he was looking at his next victim, but I know that I was becoming, in his eyes, more insolent. We were driving home, close to my home, and he'd hit me for some reason and bent my finger back and then reach across to touch me. I'd just had enough, and I pushed him away, went to open the door. He obviously had to stop the car, and I just ran. I just ran to my home. He never darkened the door, as my mum says again, after that. And we never, when I say we never saw him, I saw him at Blackpool, but he never came round to the house. And for me, that was the end of it. Not the end of my problems, but the end of the abuse.
And was there no explanation when you go home that evening or over the following evenings, considering it's
my
mum
said to me,
years.
Is he hit you again? Because I was, you know, I was crying. I didn't really say yes or no. He never came round the house. For me, you know, it was the end of the abuse, obviously, but not the end of the problems that I ensued.
Was there an instant feeling of relief, though? Was it suddenly easier to sleep at night?
I've got to be honest, I didn't know that he wouldn't darken the door, as my mum says again. So, I, you know, at the time, I'd got away from him, and I'd made my first moves to get away from him. I didn't think for one minute that he wouldn't come and sweet talk his way round. So I've got to be honest, I probably, every time there was a knock at the door, I probably was in fear for a few weeks until I realised that he wasn't going to come round again.
I guess at 15 as well, he realises you're now quick enough to run away.
Yeah.
You're plus getting I'm bigger, getting you're physically getting taller, stronger, that you can actually strike back.
And do you
back.
Know what, like, as you alluded to earlier, he may have already looked at his next victim.
He didn't leave your life completely, and there are parts of this as we move into the football story, and you go to Blackpool, you leave home, you're not moving that far away from home, but you're moving into Diggs at 16, 17. With all that's just gone before, are you ready for that step? Are you ready to be away from your parents?
Yeah, do you know what? And
were you haunted by your home house?
No, I wasn't haunted, but for me, I was going to do something that I dreamed of, so... I wasn't homesick because I was getting to do what I've always wanted to do. I wanted to play football. And like you said, you know, Blackpool to Manchester isn't that long. Mm. You know, my dad did get a car eventually, so it wasn't like I didn't see them. But for me, I didn't think about that. I just thought about football, football, football.
He's described as a shadow from your past around Blackpool. He was a scout at Blackpool. He was still there on a regular basis. Had you any interaction with Roper?
Not really, no. I used to feel physically sick when I saw him, I've got to be honest, but I genuinely tried to just blank everything out that happened to me.
How did you block it all out?
Well, I thought that I'd locked it away in a box in the back of my mind. I know I was very angry as a youth footballer, even going into to my early 20s. You know, I did... discipline. I suffered badly with the discipline on the field.
Are you drinking at that stage?
Well, we were a drinking culture. You know, Sam Ellis, the manager, his idea of getting a good team spirit was the lads to go out. So yeah, I was drinking, but not to the extent that I was later on in my career. It was genuinely more a social thing.
It seems as though it's such a small circle football in the northwest of England, because he keeps popping up. You meet your wife, Bev, who comes across so heroically in this book what she managed to deal with over the past 40 years.
You know, that's the truth.
You're only, what were you, 18 when you met, 20, 21 when you're getting married.
Yep.
Again, you're diving deep into a relationship very shortly after the abuse stopped. The story you have of one of the rows you're having around the wedding is whether or not to invite Frank Roper to the wedding, that nobody can understand why.
Well, I haven't invited him, and that's right. And maybe that was an opportunity to say why then, but not. I didn't see it as that. And you know what? You probably ask, when people ask me, did I say anything? And my wife had an inclination that something had happened in my childhood, but we never ever talked about it. And when I wouldn't invite him to the wedding under any circumstances, I was never asked a question why. I just said that he wasn't coming to the wedding.
Your wife and your mother both suspected something, and both maybe suspected something around Roper. Yep. It seems both thought it was probably some sort of physical abuse. Your mother knew that there was some sort of physical abuse, never quite as serious as it was. Over the years, and there were good nights out, bad nights out, heavy nights out with drink, with drugs. Were there times during that when you'd end up with your wife or your brother or family where you would say something?
No, I think, you know, my brothers say that on two occasions that I alluded to it in drink. I don't remember them, whether I was, in oblivion at the time in drink, but I don't remember that. But it never seemed to be something that I would do. I didn't want to burden anyone with it, if I'm honest. At that stage, I didn't want to put a burden on anyone and blame something for my actions.
Now that you have told them, like, blame something for my actions, like, there were no actions.
I know, but I still, you know, and I'm asked this question a lot, but I have a lot of regrets. I regret my actions and the heartache that I've put on my family, on my wife, and how my children have been able, you know, they haven't had what a father should give. And I do regret an awful lot that I wasn't able to be what I want to be, what inside I feel, but I can't do on the outside.
That developed as you went through life then and you started to have children and probably the stress of that and the stress of football, and you turn to drink and you ultimately end up turning to drugs. But on one side, you had a very successful football career. You played for Tottenham. You were man of the match in an FA Cup final. You played for England. And like, I think you're 100% right in what you were just saying, that if this abuse hadn't happened, like, God knows what you would have gone and achieved, not having to deal with that sort of stress. You go to Manchester City. So you went to City when you were a boy, probably to go and watch them. And then you end up signing for them. You get that big move from Blackpool. Like, despite what had happened, you're not this shy, meek, retiring boy who's going to City. You describe your contract negotiations. You don't have an agent. You're well able to stand up for yourself.
Yeah. And I think I have been able to stand up for myself most of my life, apart from the... You know, when I was a child, but I wasn't a pushover, and I've always been a strong character. Mm. But you know, is that a cover up for the real me sometimes? So, you know, is that a front for really what's going on in the back?
Yeah. Do you ask that question about often. All aspects of your life, of what is the real
I'm
me?
I'm always asking that question about myself, and do you know, I don't like to make excuses that I did this because of that, and I don't want to put, you know, I'm not one person that says because of that, I try to say, you know, you still make decisions yourself, Paul. When I took the first line of cocaine, nobody pushed my nose into that. I took that myself on my own accord. When I struggled with drugs and drink, that was still my decision. So, you know, I still blame myself for that.
Yeah, but ultimately... And I don't know if you discovered this more as you wrote the book and went back through it. Ultimately, you'd have to assume everything goes back.
Yeah. I mean,
to Roper.
Yeah, I'm learning that is the case. But you know, I'm not a person that makes excuses for his actions all the time. And as much as it is the root cause of it, I still have made them decisions to take and drink. That, you know, that drink and take that drug, and that I still think I'm held responsible for that.
Before the drugs, then, when you go to City, it's your local club, you're the hometown hero, and before you move to the bright lights of London, is that a happy time?
Yeah, I think so, because you know, I went as a striker, and apart from us, you know, I was there a year and 3 months. The season in the first division, when I scored the 30 goals, of course there was happy times. But I still think I was looked upon. I still felt angry. I still had that anger inside me. Whether it was, you know, can we think that might be determination that you know, whatever it was, I never felt it was good enough. Whatever I did, I didn't feel it was good enough.
Were you rid of Roper at that stage? Was he arriving at City games?
Thank God I didn't know, but another child that he abused, he brought to a City game that I was playing in, telling that child that he made me the player that I am, and that was
what I could do for you.
Yeah, that's exactly what he did, and we know that because the adult now contacted and. He told his story that's what he did. So, yeah. But I didn't know he was in the stands. No idea. And I was rid of him then well and truly.
You'd obviously made a decision that you weren't going to tell anybody about this, that you were going to keep it all in. Was there any part of you worried that this would come out some other way, that people would find out, that this would become the story?
No, I didn't worry about it. And had it happened, I might not at that time have admitted that it happened to me. Mm. I might have still kept quiet. You know, there was, you go through stages where as a child, you don't know how to handle it and you feel you've got nowhere to turn. Then as a young adult, I didn't want it to be seen to be a trouble causer. Then as somebody who's older, the embarrassment of it, you don't say anything because of the embarrassment. So, you know, the stages of not saying anything are so different as you get older. Why did I say it when I was 52? Because I knew that other people were suffering, had suffered. I wanted them to address it, see the mistakes I've made because of the abuse, and hopefully they don't follow the same path, if I'm honest.
Yeah, because the earlier people can come to terms with this, yeah, clearly the better, because it's, you're probably mid-20s before things start to go badly wrong,
yeah,
and that you get involved in drugs, and the move to London is probably a big part of that. And that's the period of your career people remember you most.
Yeah.
The FA Cup final, playing for England. How did the move to Spurs come about?
Well, like I just said to you, you know, that season at City when I banged
scored
early
a lot of goals
in, you know, people were coming to watch me, you know. There was a tapping up scenario in them days, so you knew that clubs were coming in for you when they were coming in for you. Everton were a team, and Tottenham were another team, and we used to call it, there was a top six then, you know, and these teams were in the top six, and I travelled down to, I mean, they accepted 1.7 million for me, and I travelled down to London, met Terry Venables, and he just sold the club to me, told me about the plans of Gascoigne coming, Chris Waddle was already there, you know, Gary Mabbott was there, there was great players already there, and what he was looking to do, just sold everything to me.
Gazza signs the very next day,
yep,
500 grand more. You end up sharing an apartment together, yep, down in London. It's probably a rhetorical question to say, was it a fun time?
Yeah, without doubt, it was a fun time. Do you know what? I mean, ironically, we both suffer and have suffered with demons, you know. Again, I saw the problems Paul was having with his OCD and his bulimia, but I didn't know what it was. I just thought it was one of his quirks. So, do you know, when you talk about society, his problems were only brought to the forefront when Diana said that she suffered from bulimia. You know, all the way along here, it was a society issue, and the awareness wasn't out there that is out there today. And that's of the illnesses that he has experienced and the abuse that I experienced.
Does that cast a shadow when you think back on those times at Tottenham, what you were both going through, what you were both hiding?
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? I wish I'd have been able to identify what Paul's problems were. I'm not so sure I would have been able to do anything, you know, because I think Paul was and one of the greatest players, if not the greatest I played alongside, and you just accepted all his quirks because of what he was doing on the pitch. The manager accepted them. Everybody accepted them. And nobody thought, oh, he's got OCD or he's got bulimia when he was making himself sick. It never crossed your mind, because he'd then go out on a Saturday and he was unbelievable. So what can be wrong with somebody that can do that?
Yeah. That's,
you know what I mean? You don't identify that he's got a problem because of the performances he was putting out on the pitch.
Do you still talk to Paul?
I still talk to him. I spoke to him on Monday.
How's he now?
He's good at the moment. You know, I think he's aware that it can happen at any time. I'm aware that it can, but him and I are friends beyond our issues. So, you know, he accepts me for what I am, and I accept Paul when he's had a drink and when he's not had a drink. And, you know, he knows that he's two different people, but he's working his hardest to address it. And you know, we're just friends, and
you support him where you can.
I'll always, you know, be there for him. You know, he's a friend, and I know out of drink, Paul is the real Paul Gascoigne. What happens in drink is you've just got to accept that it's the drink that makes Paul like that.
you were absolute superstars back then.
Well, he was. I don't think I was.
I think you were up there with him. Like, and there was a lot of attention focused on Paul for the partying side of it, and you were alongside him for a lot of that. Did you enjoy the spotlight?
I never enjoyed the spotlight. I think it was a part of the game that was frustrating for me. You know, I found it difficult when I went into places that were busy. I'm still not fond of the spotlight, and you know, one of the decisions to come forward was knowing I was going to go back into the spotlight for very different reasons, and that isn't something that I enjoy at all. But I look at and I weigh up what it is doing for other people by me telling my story, and it's a no-brainer for me. If I have to be on the TV, on the radio, in the papers all the time, and people are hearing my story, and then they're aware of the dangers, and they look at what happened and what I, you know, the self-destruction I went through, and they can address it, then if it just helps one person, then I've got to say it would have been worthwhile.
Where it seems to transform from being largely a fun time in London to a really horrible time and turns into such a bad period of your life is when your family end up having to move back to Blackpool. I don't know, is your wife homesick and she just wants to get back?
Well, she's an identical twin, and you know, at the time when I was young, maybe it would have been different if I'd have gone to Everton, because we would have remained in Blackpool, and she is very close. You know, she speaks to her sister 10, 15 times a day if she doesn't see her on the phone, and that, you know, there is a bond there that identical twins have. And, you know, I've lived through that and seen it. So I understood that, you know, she wasn't happy down in London. I made the decision for us to go to Tottenham. And, you know, it just wasn't right for my wife.
That's all happening around the time of the 91 Cup final, which is the real heyday of the FA Cup, from probably 88 to 91, from Wimbledon, Liverpool United, through to Spurs and Gaza in the semi-final, and picking up the injury. Like, you score in the FA Cup final, you're mad at the match. Everything you'd dreamed about, everything you'd went through to get to your dream, does it all feel worthwhile after the Cup final?
Yeah, sure. You know, I know that the this book for people is difficult to read, but in there I did manage to forge a career. I did have some real highs in that time. So I speak about the laughs and the jokes that we had. I'm trying to do, and it is very difficult because I'm addressing a subject that people don't want to address, but you've seen in there that we had laughs and jokes. I don't walk around with a cloud over my head every day of the week. Yes, of course, I have good days and bad days, but I think I'm managing them. But, you know, the story in that book is an important story because I know that people suffer in silence, and what I did, I don't want them to do. So if they can take some solace and seek help, then, you know, all that's been worthwhile.
When did the drugs start?
Towards the end of my last year at Tottenham.
And was that just the social circle you were in?
No, it wasn't. I got offered it in a club in London, and you know, when I took that first line of cocaine, I thought it was the answer to all my prayers. You know, all of a sudden I had no bad thoughts. I felt that I was invincible.
How long did that last?
30 minutes, if that. Then you want the next one and the next one. Everybody knows the story. The worst thing about it is when there is none and you're coming down, because as bad as you felt before, you feel 10 times as bad when you're coming down.
It almost feels during that period, having got to such a high, having delivered on the biggest stage at Wembley, that you almost go through a period of self-sabotage, that you get called up for England and you turn up for your first England call-up drunk.
Yeah.
You're getting a move to Liverpool, and as you're going to sign, Graeme Souness comes in, you're sitting there having had 10 drinks.
Yeah, I know. And I was going into self-destruct mode. And, you know, to the last year at Spurs, and then the start of my career, you know, it looked, for all intents and purposes, the best move. I was going back home. I was playing for one of the biggest clubs in the world that you would have walked on broken glass to play for. And I was in self-destruct mode. I've openly said that I didn't get on with Graeme Souness. You know, I didn't like him as a person, but have also said that it wasn't his fault that I didn't succeed at Liverpool. You know, I was in self-destruct mode and never gave myself a chance to succeed.
Does football try and help you when you're in that self-destruct mode? Because I think back to when you signed for Liverpool. I remember being excited when you signed for Liverpool. That
not as much as I was. Honestly, you know, it was a dream move for me.
And you score one goal, one league goal throughout your years at Liverpool, throughout the two real seasons you had at Liverpool before you go out on loan. Are people trying to turn you around at Liverpool?
No, do you know, back then in the 90s when you weren't in the first team, you weren't, nobody really cared about you. I ended up training with the kids because that was nobody's fault but my own, because I wasn't looking after myself. I was drinking so much and taking so many drugs, then I can't really perform. How can I expect to perform with that inside me?
The drinking you probably could have got away with, considering the drink culture was there. It seemed every successful club during the 90s.
I think when you're taking drugs, you drink even more because you have that ability to drink even more. So perhaps not, you know what I mean? The team that I played with at Liverpool was a drinking culture. But I don't think it was to the extent that I drank.
The side with the drugs as well is that it can actually destroy your career if you're caught. Were there testing? Was there close calls?
There was, yeah. How do you call it close? It was random testing. They used to come to the training ground, put all the names in a hat, including the reserves and the juniors, and pick four names out. I just gambled that my name wouldn't get taken out. And it didn't. All of a sudden, you feel that you're invincible, don't you? I got caught in London coming out of a nightclub. The police pulled me because they saw what I was doing, asked me to empty my pockets. I pulled out the cocaine, and the policeman said to me, you're Paul Stewart, aren't you? Play for Spurs. Get on your way. You know, who knows if I'd have been arrested, addressed it, what might have happened, but it just seemed that I was either lucky or unlucky, whichever way you look at that.
Are those later years then, as you're heading towards retirement and you're out on various loan spells, you end up at Sunderland at a stage as well, are they just a wasteland?
No, you know what? I got myself cleaned for Sunderland and played for Peter Reid and really enjoyed it. I proved something to myself that I could play and play at the top level again without the need of drink or drugs. So for me, I needed to get out of Liverpool. You know, as soon as I'd got the sack, Roy Evans had took over. You know, they were never going to play me. Whatever the situation with the players, with injuries or anything, I would have been the last one that would have got called up. So, you know, I'd probably had a year to go, and I was thinking, you know, nobody was coming in for me. I'd got that reputation. You know, my career could have been over. Mm. And really gave me, as I see, another chance. And I really worked hard and took that chance.
Facing retirement then, and you have gone through more than anyone should ever have to go through, and you're doing and you're putting up with that because of wanting to be a professional footballer, and you get to go and you do live the dream and you play the cup final, and then it ends. What's your life like from when you fall out of the public eye to when you reemerge last year?
Firstly, back then you were never prepared. Nobody prepared you to the end of your career. You know, once the phone stopped ringing and nobody wants to play you, you go. And do you know what? I realised that we were so spoiled as professional footballers. We never had to make a doctor's appointment, dentist appointment. If we went to the doctors, we were rushed to the front of the queue. Go to an airport, never had to check in. Somebody did it for us. Do you know, everything was done for you. I suddenly finished playing and what do you mean I've got to make a doctor's appointment? What do you mean? You know, menial things, but you realised how mamby-pambied you were. So you have to readjust that way, first of all. And it's very difficult because I'm working with 30 lads day in, day out, having a laugh and a joke, almost like school, to go into, well, here we go, here's real life, Paul. It isn't all roses.
Yeah, suddenly you're back home, minding the kids again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was just not being prepared for you. Whilst you're in the moment, you don't think the career's going to end. Once it ends, it just stops. There's no readjustment from, okay, stay with us for 6 months and we'll tell you what real life is like. I mean, I know that that nowadays it's different for players, but back then it was, you know, playing was playing, and then once you're finished, nobody wanted to know you.
How long did it take to get to grips then with real life? Probably when you retire, you've got a bit of cash, you think it's going to last forever.
Yeah, and you know what? Nobody's retired at 35, are they? So you know, socialising, you're either people that are retired are generally 65, 70, and a 35-year-old, and this is no disrespect to anyone that's 65 or 70, but at 35, you're not really... You've not much in common with people that age, so
no.
So it becomes boring.
So what did you do to alleviate the boredom?
I started a business, to be honest. I went back to the football clubs that I'd spent most of my life at, and noticed that they had TV screens in there, and went back with a proposition of running a program on there that can self-promote themselves. So I started, a business doing that. Digital signage, you know, we call it now.
Okay,
but at the time, it was just me using their TVs to promote. You know, we know that they had games on, but they also had conference suites. They also had weddings. And I said, why don't you put that on the screen? Sell whatever events that you've got. And that's how that started.
By the sounds of it in the book, that's all going well. Mm. So going back to this time last year, and you decide, yes, I'm going to step forward. And it seems from reading the book that you're ready for this moment, because instantly you're going out for dinner that night with your wife and her sister and her husband, and you tell them. Within a couple of days, you've pretty much informed everybody.
Yeah. I mean, the night was arranged anyway.
Mm.
We were always going to that concert, but I saw the story in the mirror on the Friday afternoon. And to be honest with you, I was instantly emailing back to who wrote that story. And then it dawned on me that I hadn't told anyone. I had the perfect opportunity because we are a close family. I'm close to my brother-in-law and sister-in-law. So I knew that I didn't need to be with my wife. And in some ways it was easy with them sat there to say what I was going to do. And then had to tell my children.
How was that?
You don't go into the full extent of it. You know, I think they only realised when they read the paper the full extent of the abuse. So, because I didn't want to say too much to them, I didn't want to upset them, but I wanted to make them aware that we're going to possibly be thrown into the spotlight here and not about football. The hardest one was driving to my parents on the Sunday and having to tell my mum and dad. They were elderly, of course, and I knew that what was going to happen was they were instantly going to blame themselves, and I needed to make sure that they didn't do that. And I know, as you've quite rightly alluded to in the book there, that my mum does have nightmares about it, but I still try and reiterate every day that, you know, there's only one person to blame, and that was Frank Roper.
And I'm sure one of the first questions for most people was, where is he now?
Yeah.
Let's go get him. Where was Frank Roper?
Well, we struggled. Obviously, when I told my story, there became a manhunt, if you will, to find him. We were looking for somebody called Frank Roper, and that wasn't his given name. It was
right.
James Francis Roper. So every avenue that the police explored, and, you know, they even went overseas at one point, they were looking for a Frank Roper. And, of course, you know, had they typed in James Francis Roper, then his death certificate would have come up. But he died in 2005 in a hospice in Stockport near Manchester.
So he never saw any sort of justice?
No, and I know your next question is going to be, how did I feel about that? Because it's a question everybody asks, and it didn't change what I wanted to do by telling my story. My wife was devastated, my kids were, because somebody had harmed the father, they wanted to see justice. Mm. If I seek revenge, that means he's still got some sort of hold over me in death, because he's still affecting my life. So for me, I wasn't prepared to lose any sleep over him being dead. I wanted to focus on why did I come forward and tell my story, and it was in the hope that it would help other people.
There's no question it has helped other people. 31 people have come forward about Frank Roper alone. Hundreds of people have come forward about Barry Bunnell. A lot of talk, and he's going to go to trial, Barry Bunnell, very early in 2018. A lot of this focused on areas in the Northwest, on football clubs in the Northwest, and who knew what and who knew what when. Are you able to rationalise that, that when you look at the football clubs you're involved in and when you look at people involved in football in the Northwest, that people may have known and people may have kept quiet?
We take different views on it as players, and I understand that some players are seeking compensation for what happened to them, and I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I still speak to my manager at Blackpool, Sam Ellison. He's a close friend. I didn't tell him. My coach that was there, who's now passed away, has living relatives. I didn't tell him. So as far as I'm concerned, it wasn't their fault. I'm not looking to blame.
You didn't want answers from them?
No, because I didn't tell them. I can't blame them if I didn't tell them.
Mm.
There's only one person to blame. We know that, and he's dead. So, and again, I don't want to focus on a negative thing, really, about whose fault was it. And, you know, what I want to do is try and do something positive with while I've got a voice, and that is to make change.
You say quite early in the book that when you were telling your former teammates, when you were telling your family and about their reaction, that you hadn't changed, that you had come to terms with your life before your secret was out. Having sat down and written this book now, with everything that's gone on in the past year, has your life, are you a very different person now?
My answer to that is it has remained the same since I wrote the book. Is you would have to ask those who are the closest to me what they think about Paul Stewart, because, do you know, with something like this, it isn't a light switch that you switch on and off. 42 years of keeping it wrapped up. In 12 months, can I get rid of 42 years? I don't think so. So rather than me answer that, I think it's probably better left to those closest to me.
You're a remarkable man, Paul. It's an incredibly brave story. As I said, it's not your normal football autobiography.
No.
It's probably not an autobiography you're going to lie on the beach and read. It's something you're going to sit down, and it's difficult parts through it. But with everything that's going on, and particularly on the year anniversary of Andy Woodward coming forward, I think it is very much an essential read. Thanks for your honesty. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, no. Thank you for inviting me. It's been my pleasure.
Off the Ball on News Talk. In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.